This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There's this great book called Vermont Place Names, Footprints of History, first published in the 1970s. It's been through three printings, but I think it's actually out of print right now. It was written by a Vermont librarian and historian named Esther Monroe Swift. It's kind of a Bible for people interested in how Vermont places have the names they do. And it's important, really, because these names are supposed to connect us to our history. Alberg, Chittenden, Wheelock, all named after important early historical figures. Vermont Place Names, the book, explains them all. Other names are more fanciful, especially names we have for rivers, brooks, and mountains, and these are sometimes harder to trace. Former state archivist Gregory Sanford likes to tell the story of how he pushed to have one of our most famous mountains renamed, or at least to have an apostrophe added, Camel's Hump. Sanford said, could we at least add an apostrophe to the first word so that it suggests a reference to the hump on the back of a camel? Because as it stands now, it's a sentence, Camel's Hump. That's what they do. Well, whether you support an apostrophe or not, we're going to talk about Vermont place names today, and we have a couple of distinguished guests to add to our conversation. Mark Bushnell writes about Vermont history and culture. Welcome back to the show, Mark.
No, thank you, Jane.
And Martha Reed is the state librarian, and Marty's also a member of the Geographic Naming Committee, which decides on official names for places in Vermont. Welcome back to you as well, Marty.
Thanks, Jane.
So I mentioned a very interesting recent place name debate that you were a part of in your role, Marty, on the Geographic Naming Committee, and that's the question of whether or not a brook in Plainfield could be named Garth Brook, with two tributaries who were going to be called North Branch Garth Brook and South Branch Garth Brook, giving us, wait for it, Garth Brooks. That's not the name it eventually got. Why not?
That's very true, and it was a really interesting process to go through this naming. The proposal for that Garth Brook actually first went to the U.S. Board on Geographic Names. There is a website. Citizens can propose names to the U.S. Board, and that's how this name came in. And the U.S. Board then typically calls the state. The state entity here is the Vermont Board of Libraries. And so we started the process to look into that. And one of the first things we did was contact the town of Plainfield. They went through a whole process, which included the Conservation Commission, town meeting, came back to us and said, we do not want that name.
They're not country music fans?
I think that they worried that this body of water, this 5-mile brook that originates on Spruce Mountain, would have a name that would be considered by some a joke, and they want to avoid that. So if you're interested in the rest of the process, they took this to the Conservation Commission. The Conservation Commission did a very wonderful job of deliberation and researched the history of the area and the brook, and brought back a selection of names to be considered by town residents and the select board. Eventually, they proposed the name Meskaskeek Brook, which is, I understand, a Banneke name.
Right.
And that came to the board in October. They approved the name after a public hearing. And just on the 7th, just last Saturday, they had a naming ceremony, which included the burning of sweetgrass.
And why does the Board of Libraries get to decide in Vermont?
Well, that's an interesting question, too. And there are about 5 states in the country where the naming authority is either part of the state library agency or a library at the university. And in every case, it's because that's where the maps were kept and the research was done on names. So that's why it came initially to the state librarian, the state geologist, and someone from the Historical Society. And over the years, that's come to the Board of Libraries now for that.
And it is still a 3-person commission, and you are on it.
No, it's a 7. It's a 7-member board, and the state librarian is the secretary, but not a voting member.
Oh, interesting. So you don't get a vote.
I don't. I get to do all the hard work behind it.
Let's bring all of our listeners into the conversation, and Mark, we'll bring you back in here, too, and talk about some of the interesting place names in Vermont, and we can continue talking about how places are named and how the U.S. board and the state boards interact and who gets jurisdiction. There's been an interesting case in Vermont about that in recent years, about a reservoir and whether or not it could be called a reservoir, so we'll get into that. And listeners, I'd love to know what oddly named places you really love, what stories you've heard over the years, or maybe what questions you have about place names. Horseneck Island, Tickle Naked Pond, just a couple of examples. And if you want to ask yours, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Betsy in Moncton highlighted State's Prison Hollow Road in Moncton, and I drive by that every day. Love that name too, Betsy. Heather mentioned Texas Falls in Hancock. Linda says, we live in a town named Gaysville. It was at one time, before the 1927 flood, a growing metropolis with a variety of industries. All roads lead to Gaysville was the quote of the day. The name came from an early influential settler with the surname of Gay. All right, so share yours again, 1-800-639-2211. Mark Bushnell, what's one of your favorite odd or interesting place names in Vermont?
Would think of the Lemon Fair River, which I think was mentioned in the promo. It's in Addison, and I think what I like about it is that there are just so many theories of where the name came from, some more plausible than others. It's all probably through local legend that there was a woman who was walking along it and looked at this slow-running river and thought, oh, what a lamentable affair. So that's a little bit weak. But, I mean, then there was a thought that maybe there was a lamentable affair that got immortalized by this Lemon Fair River, though it was mispronounced. And the lamentable affair might have been a drowning or possibly an Indian attack. There's also another theory that it actually comes from the French for the Green Mountains, Les Monts Verts. That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, that sounds plausible.
And Esther Swift, who you mentioned earlier, said actually that she came down on the side that it was an Anglicization of the French name for the river, which is Limon Fer, L-I-M-O-N, which means silt. So it means to make silt. So it maybe there's a river expert out there who would know if it was a particularly silty river.
Well, so that's so interesting because there are all these plausible explanations, and yet nobody seems to know. So that's one that's essentially still a mystery.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Esther in the book, if you read it, is pretty confident that she's got it nailed. And I mean – it's already a 700-page book, and she probably couldn't have gone into much more detail.
But
I'm just going to trust her.
I should let our listeners know, too. I mentioned that this book is kind of the Bible if you're trying to look up Vermont place names. And the three of us here each have our own copy of it. So collectively, I guess we have, 2,100 pages worth of Vermont place names? And listen, it's a heavy book. So, I mean, Mark is not kidding. This is a real hefty book. So names. She has a ton of place names. We've got a lot of listeners with questions about place names. Now, Mark and Marty, I'm not saying you have to be the experts on this. You don't have to know every answer, but I'm hoping you'll know some of them at least. We got a question from Art who says, the state claims that the deepest lake in the state is Lake Willoughby, whereas the local historian insists that the official name is Willoughby Lake. Who's correct and why? Uh-oh.
Got me on that one.
State librarian.
I'm deferring
to local librarian. All right. So if anybody out in Lake Willoughby, if you're in the area, if you know, let us know. What do you think? Lake Willoughby, Willoughby Lake. Michael has a question about pronunciation, which is one that I think a lot of Vermonters have, especially newcomers who haven't grown up with these names just ingrained in your head this way. He wants to know how Callis became pronounced Callis instead of Calais for the French.
Oh, that's a great question. I don't know the answer, but I've
often... Uh-oh. I'm betting 0 for 2 so far.
Yeah, I've always just assumed that was the way you'd say it, you know, if you were a Vermont farmer.
Yeah, but so many Vermont farmers were originally French Canadians. It seems interesting
maybe
to me.
Maybe not
that,
in Calais.
No, that's true. Or no, Vergennes or Montpellier.
But there is one that, I mean, everyone talks about Charlotte. Uh-huh. And everyone thinks, oh, well, you know, how did Vermonters mess that one up? And actually, I think they're correct because it's named after the wife of King George III, who was German, and her name was Charlotta. So Charlotte, I think
okay,
we got it.
Okay, but Mark, so now you need to settle a dispute for me because we have a friendly listener, hello out there, who gets mad. I used to live in Charlotte, and I do put a little bit of an R in there, Charlotte. And she says, no, it should be like shallot, but with the emphasis on the lot. So there's no R at all. But if you're saying it comes from Charlotta, then maybe I'm okay saying Charlotte.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think it also may just be the version of a New England accent that you have.
Yeah, which is not very thick.
Right.
All right. Questions, more thoughts, more stories you want to share, 1-800-639-2211. Tammy in Shaftesbury says, we love Terrible Mountain, which is said with tremors and dramatic effect driving over Route 100 from Weston to Ludlow. Another great name here in Shaftesbury is Holy Smoke Road. It does have some great views. And another fun one is Lost Lake Road in Arlington. My two eldest used to enjoy taking the turn down that road every now and then and trying to find the Lost Lake, which is nowhere to be found. Marty, that is sort of a wonderful thing about these names. I mean, some of them, as Mark said, are related to people or to other places in the world, perhaps where settlers came from. But some of these names are pretty fanciful and fun. And so maybe we don't have Garth Brook, but some of these names are just, they do sort of tickle your fancy.
That's true. But the board today really holds to the statute that gives guidance on how names are selected and what kinds of names. And the statute, I'll just quote from this, the board in choosing names shall give preference to historic events, historic persons, and flora and fauna native to Vermont, names characteristic to Vermont and its traditions, and local place names where long usage has been appropriate and useful. So when they get name proposals, they really go back to the statute and try to apply that as carefully as they can. And I have a lot of conversations with the folks down at the U.S. Board on Geographic Names, and it's really interesting to me the care that people take to naming geographic features. And when you think about it, these names are lasting. They go on our maps. They're discussed. So it's important that we name them properly, I suppose, but so that we've lost a little bit of that whimsical nature of naming.
Although maybe not in the roads so much, because now you're not going to have jurisdiction over the roads. It's going to be with, what, the Agency of Transportation?
The Transportation Board will name state roads and highways.
All right, so petition the Transportation Board if you want a whimsical road. Let's, you know, the librarians. No
or
fun.
Your local municipality.
Well, the funny thing is that you have all these whimsical names already on the map, and
right.
There's something about the fact that they've been there for 100 years, 200 years, that makes them sort of special to us.
I mean, like Tickle Naked
Tickle
Pond.
Naked Pond,
yeah.
Which is one of those other things where people tried to say it in English, and it's apparently a Delaware Indian name that no one could pronounce, so they came up with Tickle Naked, and they were probably having fun with it. But it actually apparently means – it refers to creatures that were seen nearby, which were beaver kits, beaver babies.
Oh, no kidding.
Which is almost as cute as Tickle Naked.
We actually got a note about that from Michael, who says, when I lived in my first Vermont home, which straddled the town line of Newbury and Reigate in the village of Boltonville near Wells River, we paid taxes to Reigate, so we were eligible to swim at the town beach on Tickle Naked Pond. No one seemed to know how it got its name. Fascinating, since Reigate's churches are Presbyterian. So Michael surmises maybe it was a local's attempt to rebel against strict Calvinism. But it sounds like, Mark, you're dashing those dreams.
Oh, I think it might have. I mean, that might have been why it got its pronunciation.
Huh. Let's go to Neil, who's calling in from Williston. Hi, Neil. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. A number of years ago, my father was coming back from a little vacation trip, and he drove through an area in southern Vermont at the southern tip of Lake Dunmore called Satan's Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me what I had done to give it that name, and I've always kind of wondered, how did it get that name?
Yeah, good question. We have other people questioning that. And in fact, we were just talking, Neil, about that before the show started, and it sounds like...
The best theory that, again, as the late Esther Swift came up with was that it was named by an early settler who had bought what he thought were lovely, fertile lands and found nothing but rocks, and therefore gave it that name.
And one of you had heard a story that maybe it was supposed to be renamed something with heaven in the title, so we were going to swap it for...
That's right. We the U.S. board had an inquiry from, I assume, a citizen of Vermont about changing that name to, I think, Heaven's Gate, Heaven something, Paradise. I don't remember.
All right. So it could happen. We got a note from Chris who says, why does Vermont have so few Indian names compared to Maine? Maine has Presumpscot, Passamaquoddy, Contoocook, or Contoocook. book. I can never remember how you're supposed to say that. And he says, by the way, Lemon Fair is a very silty river, so maybe that's
oh,
right.
Good.
Now, you mentioned, Marty, in the brook that you just officially named, you did give it an Abenaki name, or if we're using the actual way the language is spoken, it would be Abenaki. So why do you think we don't have more Abenaki or Abenaki names?
I mean, I think in the current practice and how names come to be before the Board of Libraries, I just think it's a matter of who's proposing what's names. But I love the fact that this last naming was an Abenaki name. And it was interesting at the public hearing, we had a woman who was an expert on the language and talked to us about the form of the word, the spelling. So I think it would be wonderful to have more of those names, but it's just a matter of who's bringing the names to the forefront, I guess.
John is on the line with us from Brattleboro. Hi, John. Go right ahead.
Hi. I think I know why Calais is pronounced Calais and not Calais.
Okay.
And it's because at the time that the French named the place, S's were still being pronounced at the ends of most words in French. So the French would have said it's something along the lines of Calais or Calais. And so that's how you end up with Calais or Calais in English. While, you know, had the French been saying Calais at the time of settling the area, then we'd be calling it Calais or something like Calais, but we're not, and that's why.
Oh, John, interesting. I hadn't heard that. That's an interesting thought. Mark, have you heard that? You've done a lot of
No, I haven't
history.
Heard that, but and I wonder if that has something to do with the reason we call it Montpellier, because that's named apparently after the city in France, Montpellier.
Yes. So, but no S on the name of Montpellier.
No, but maybe they had other things that changed within the language.
Oh, interesting. John, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. We are talking about Vermont place names today. We're looking at how some interesting places got their names. We'd love to hear your stories if you have any about places that have really spoken to you. Maybe you've researched them, looked them up, or maybe we can look them up for you in Vermont Place Names, Footprints of History, this book that all three of us have that's in its third printing now. So if you want to share your questions for us, or if you have a question for Marty Reed about what it's like to serve on the Geographic Naming Committee and how they make their decisions, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking about how Vermont places get their sometimes bizarre names. We're talking with State Librarian Marty Reed, who's part of the Geographic Naming Committee for the state, and Mark Bushnell, a chronicler of Vermont. And you can tell us about the places that have always left you scratching your head. Call 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Viola, who's calling in from Groton. Hi, Viola. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering how they got a name, Gulf for a road and Gore for a town.
Viola, good question, and we actually got another one who says, this is Jordan in Cornwall, who says, I've always wondered about the use of the term gulf in Vermont to describe narrow valleys or passes. Jordan says, I drive through the Hubbardton Gulf and Proctor Gulf with some frequency and wants to know if there are others or if this term is used in other places and where it comes from. So Viola and Jordan both wondering about the term gulf, and then we've got gores as well. Marty, do you know the answers to those?
I don't, and I should. The state librarian actually is the arbiter of terminology, so I'm going to have to go home and do some research.
Mark, do you
know? I don't know where the word gore came from. No, I mean, it was just sort of little bits of land that never got –
They're unincorporated towns,
exactly.
Right? So, and I think we have four of them in Vermont.
Yeah, and I do know that gulfs exist at least in Pennsylvania where I've seen them, but I've never thought of where the word came from.
Interesting.
And it's with a PH, so it's not the same as like, you know, it's not the Gulf of Mexico or, you know, the Gulf of Vermont.
Huh. Yeah. Marty, you mentioned that you are, as on your role as the Geographic Naming Committee, you are the arbiter of what things are called, like how they're designated. And in fact, that came up recently in a little bit of a dispute with the feds over whether something should be called a reservoir or a lake. Can you describe it?
That's true. Back in the 70s, the feds, the Department of the Army designated that water impounded by dams as lakes to be determined lake. And this went out to all the states. And in Vermont, that was four different reservoirs were to be called lake. And at the time, the state librarian wrote back and worked through the congressional delegation and said, Vermont doesn't want to change that. I think we were the only state that said, nope, we're going to keep that designation as a reservoir.
Well, why? This, why did you want to keep it as a reservoir?
Well, let's see. From the letter at the, of the state librarian, Catherine Nelson at the time, it said the Board of Geographic Names approved for federal use the names Ball Mountain Reservoir, North Springfield Reservoir, Townsend Reservoir. And that was the decision of the board. So I don't have the minutes from that meeting. But this came back up again in 2012. They came back to us and said, we're working on our U.S. maps, and we see that Vermont is still calling these reservoirs. By the way, it's a lake. So we brought the matter again up, went to the Board of Libraries. They declined to take action because it really was a matter of terminology. So I worked with folks over at the Agency of Natural Resources on this. We did some research on these bodies of water, and they came back and said, no, they are reservoirs. So that's what we reported back to the U.S. Board, and they said, okay, Vermont, you can do what you want, but the U.S. board on their maps calls those lakes.
So if you're buying a federal map, it's going to say lake, and if you're buying a map made in Vermont, it's going to be
reservoir. That's
interesting.
Right.
Let's go to Beverly, who's calling in from Willoughby Lake or Lake Willoughby. Beverly, which is it?
It's Willoughby Lake.
Oh.
Actually, I come from many generations of people who have lived here at Willoughby. I've lived here myself for nearly 67 years, and always this was called Willoughby Lake. So it's only been in the last bit of time that I've noticed state signs and maps and things saying Lake Willoughby. Which is kind of annoying.
So you still call it Willoughby Lake?
I do, and I wonder why it got changed. How did that happen?
Oh, yeah, that is interesting, and we don't know the answer to it. I certainly don't, and it sounds like from our earlier discussion, this was a new, just a new thing altogether for Marty and Mark on this idea of Willoughby Lake, Lake Willoughby. So there's more research to be done, Beverly. Maybe your town historian can help you out. And if you find out, please let us know, and we'll let everybody else know. Let's go to JT in Thetford. Hi, JT. Go right ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
While driving over Rochester Mountain Road on a fly fishing expedition about a month ago, my sons and I, we cracked up, we ran around the corner, and we saw a sign for Olympus, Vermont, like Olympus without the O.
Yeah.
We were on a time schedule, so we didn't go up there, but we're very curious about the origin of that town name.
JT, I share your interest in that one. I have driven over that mountain many, many times over my many years and have always loved Olympus, too. And I can tell you that both Marty and Mark are looking at the index of this book and seeing if there's an answer for you that they have about Olympus, L-Y-M-P-U-S. In Vermont, it looks like, Marty, you've got your finger on something.
Well, it says here that it takes its name from the peak, which must be Olympus. Was known as Olympus or simply Olympus.
Huh. So it was maybe originally from the Olympus. JT, good call on that, that maybe it was Olympus and now it's just Olympus. I kind of love it as Olympus. We got a note from Gordon in Northfield who says, I once lived near Berlin Pond in central Vermont where locals spoke of an area called N-Word Hill. My assumption has always been that one black family once lived around there. Are you familiar with the history of this place and how it got its unfortunate moniker? Are there other sites in Vermont that bear the racist alter ego that we'd rather not notice, much less honor? And there certainly are instances in Vermont and beyond where similarly named or other names that were racist or misogynist or otherwise objectionable. And I'd love to know if you know the story of that, but also how we deal with names that have gone out of favor culturally or are really offensive and when they're changed. Marty?
I'm not familiar with that particular name, but I know that there was the same name that was applied to a pond, and I can't remember which town this is in. And over the years, we have a very thick file on this particular pond. Name changes over time. And I can't remember what year people really looked at this and said, this is no longer appropriate. We can't sit with this name. But this is a name change that we've seen in other states. I think in the last few years, actually, there was a body of water, I think, in New Hampshire that had that name change. And in western states, we're seeing lots of names which are derogatory toward Native Americans. Squaw Mountain is one, I think, that comes up before the national board.
Hmm. Mark?
Esther Swift talks about it as she talks about everything. And she said that the name can come from the fact that an area had rounded, hard, black-colored rocks. The N-word, head, ledge, and I think there's a lake. She also said it's an old Yankee name for black-eyed Susans.
Hmm. And regardless of how it came to be, certainly not something
it
that
doesn't really belong
there
anymore.
Are comfortable with. We got a comment from Kathy who says, I don't know when the name change happened, but Fairfield Pond used to be called Dream Lake because of a murder mystery that ended after a woman dreamed where the evidence, maybe a scarf Kathy thinks, was located at what is now known as Bloody Rock in Fairfield Pond. The story made the newspapers, and the old newspapers are framed and hanging in the courthouse in St. Albans. That's very cool. Let's go to Thomas in Newport. Hi, Thomas.
Good afternoon. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Just a quick question, just out of curiosity. Moscow, Vermont. I know we're far from Russia. How in the world did it ever get such a name?
Good question, and we've got our experts looking in the book again. You know, I've always been interested in some of those names too, Thomas, because we've got Moscow, we've got Peru, we've got all of these
actually,
places.
Actually, Marty's looking. We have a section of Calais that's the Pekin Brook area.
And you're saying Peking, not pecan, the nut.
It's spelled P-E-K-I-N, but it meant Peking at the time. And it apparently came around because a farmer in Calais had a friend who was a missionary in China who sent him a gift, which was some wheat from China. And he tried it, and it worked really well. And they knew it as, things were over by that Peking wheat field.
Huh.
You know, now we'd call it, instead of Peking Brook, we'd call it Beijing Brook or something. But
but it is still known as Peking Brook?
Yeah, yeah.
Huh.
And there's a road and everything.
Mark, we had another – while Marty's looking this up, we had another listener who wanted to know about Smuggler's Notch and if this was Prohibition-related. And I know you have another Prohibition-related story as well.
Yeah, no. Actually, I believe it goes back to the smuggling in the early 1800s when there was an embargo.
Hmm.
And that was – but it probably was Prohibition era, too.
Marty, do you have an answer for us on Moscow?
Well, Ms. Swift goes on for a couple pages here, but it looks like there are two different stories about the origin. One says that the sawmill at the village had hung up a large circular saw, which was struck with a hammer and struck. Okay, the ringing of the saw lightened to the sound of the so-called Great Bell of Moscow, which is in the Kremlin.
Ah, so it's related to a sound that reminded them of the city.
At least that's one story.
Interesting. Mark, we're talking about names that are inappropriate now, and I understand you have a name that's really rankled you, not because it's inappropriate, but you, at least for a while, were not a fan of the name of the town of Killington.
It was the way that for people who don't know, it was changed, I believe, in the early 90s. And a strong argument for it was that people would go. The town was formerly known as Sherburne. And people were saying, well, people drive and they couldn't figure out where the ski mountain was, the resort. So let's just make it simple. Let's just call the resort Killington. But of course, if you look any farther back, in reality, that's the original name of the town is Killington. So, I mean, you got to let them slide on that one, I guess. And, you know, when it's, you know, in terms of naming a town after the major employer, you could do a lot worse. I mean, it could have been Santa's Village.
Right, which happily it is not. We're talking about Vermont place names. We're sharing some of our favorites. If you have a favorite place name, whether you know the story or not, and you'd love to share it with us, we would love to hear it. Go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition, or you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Chuck is calling in from South Pomfret. Hi, Chuck.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
Hi. So I have a question that you're not going to be able to answer. Esther Swift couldn't answer it, and I don't think anybody has ever come up with a satisfactory answer. I own a general store in South Pomfret, and it's called the Teago General Store, T-E-A-G-O.
Mm-hmm.
And the store is named after Teago Hill, which is just across the road. There's the Teago Store, the Teago Grange, the Teago Fire Department, and Teago Hill. And that's it.
Huh. And the, Chuck, in your research, you've never come up with some name that Teago, you know, Teago is a surname, maybe?
I mean, there are two stories.
Okay.
One is that some people were either traveling over Teago Hill in a wagon, and their barrel of tea fell out of the wagon and rolled down the hillside, and somebody said, "Oh my goodness, look at our Teago." And so they called it Teago Hill. And the other story that I've heard is that the first minister in the town, whose name I think was Aaron Hutchinson, gave the name the hill of the hill Mount Ego. I guess he knew some Greek and Latin and stuff, a little better educated than most, called it the hill Mount Ego, and that local people picked it up as Teago.
Huh. That's interesting. Well, Chuck, at least you know some stories behind it, even if, as you say, nobody in this room can help you answer the mystery. I actually love the There Goes Our Tea, the Teago story. That's really fabulous. We're talking about Vermont place names. Jen's calling in from Rutland. Hi, Jen. You have a question about Rutland?
Yes, yes. Hello. When I first moved to Vermont about 10 years ago, people were excited that we were going to this picturesque place named Vermont, but then I told them we were living in Rutland, and that just took all the beauty right out of it. How did we get such a horrible-sounding name?
But, Jen, come on now. Isn't beauty in the eye of the beholder? You may think Rutland is a terrible name, but maybe some people think it's a beautiful name.
Yeah, there is a Rutland in England. I would assume it came from that. But.
Oh, you're getting a nod here from Marty Reed, but she's looking it up just in case. But, Jen, you find Rutland to be just a horrible-sounding word?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, sadly, that's interesting. I mean, it is so interesting that names come into favor, and if you don't have an association with why it was named that, it may not even seem appealing in any way. We have a couple of listeners who have written in about gores, which we were talking about earlier. Why is something called a gore? And these are unincorporated towns. Debbie says, back to the gores, they were small sections, sort of triangular usually, that were left out of the old surveys between towns. The definition of gore is a triangular or tapering piece of material, and that's how a gore skirt is made. And we had Chris who emailed in to say the same thing. It's a triangle of fabric that's inserted into a skirt to make it full. Oh. So a triangle of land between two towns fits that description.
Oh, that's great.
It is great. Thank you. So glad to know that.
Our listeners are amazing. Yeah. It's always wonderful. We got a note from Peter in Saxton's River who says, I've been leading a waterway naming project in Rockingham for a year and a half. I led a similar project when I lived in Maryland that named 165 waterways in Anne Arundel County. The reason for these projects is that people care more about things that have names. So we hope to increase stewardship of the waterways by giving them official names. We found that in Rockingham, only 5 brooks had official names in the federal database, and none of the 5 waterfalls in and near the town had official names. So Peter's leading this charge to get them named. Do you think that's true, Mark, that people care more if they know the name? Or, you know, at least for me, when I'm walking in the woods on the trails that my family frequents, we have names for things so that we can talk about them, my husband and I. So whether there's an official name or not, I think people are going to name things. So you might as well have an official name, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think, I mean, it goes back all the way to the, you know, the Native Americans named things so they could know where to meet or just know they were on the same page. We're talking about the same place. And I think it's valuable also because it, as you drive around, you know, you'll look at a map and, you know, maybe if you've read Esther Swift's book or, you know, you'll start to you know, you'll see a sign and it will conjure up an image of a story and you'll get a little deeper sense of the place. I mean, I know a lot of people, a geologist might drive around and look at the hillsides and, you know, naturalists will notice what trees are in bloom. And I think historians or people of that ilk, you know, might think about where a name came from.
Marty Reed, this is part of your job as the state librarian, as we've talked about, is to be on this geographic naming commission. Do you like it? Is it a fun part of the gig?
It's wonderful. I have to say sometimes it's a distraction because our main work, of course, is libraries. But it's great fun. And I think Mark's right when he talks about story. I think the stories behind names are fun. They're important. They really give us our history. So yes, and the board takes this duty very seriously. They're very deliberate, but they also, I think, just take great pleasure from it.
Mark, I mean, there were a lot of questions that we couldn't answer today from listeners, but there are also so few of us know the stories behind the names, even of the towns that we live in. Should we know more than we do about why places have the names they do?
I think it would be a great idea. Sure. I mean, it's also great when there are debates too about, you know, is it this or that or, you know, but if you live in, you know, say Plymouth, then there's Money Brook is there and it sounds like it's a place where someone made a lot of money, which is literally true because that's where counterfeiters had set up. And I think knowing that kind of story can add a richness to your appreciation of a place.
Well, I want to thank both of you for sharing your thoughts, your expertise, for helping us look up things that we didn't know in this book. It's called Vermont Place Names, Footprints of History. It's by Esther Monroe Swift. It's in its third printing, but I think it may be out of print. One of our producers was trying to buy it, and he couldn't find a copy for himself. So go to your local library, see if your librarian can find it for you. State librarian Marty Reed and Mark Bushnell, writer and chronicler of Vermont, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Jane.
This has been great fun. Thanks.
Coming up, have you put your snow tires on yet? We'll talk with VTrans about why the agency says snow tires are an essential part of preparing for winter in Vermont. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We're due for a good early winter storm any time now, and it doesn't even have to be a big one for the roadways to get pretty dicey. So people are scrambling to get their snow tires on before that slick driving starts.
My name is Ed. I live in Georgia, Vermont, and I'm getting my snow tires on today. I moved here in 1972, and I know what it's like to have snow tires in the winter and not have snow tires in the winter, and I don't make that mistake anymore.
My name's Maria, and I use all-season tires all year round. I don't see the need to switch to winter tires.
All right, so not everyone is scrambling to get their snow tires on, but that's not what the Vermont Agency of Transportation wants to hear. VTrans is adamant. Snow tires are the way to go. If you've driven on Vermont highways, you've probably even seen the big digital signs aggressively suggesting that you get those snow tires on now. I am joined by Scott Rogers, Director of Maintenance and Operations for VTrans, to explain why the agency is giving us the hard sell. Scott Rogers, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So why do we need snow tires? Why can't you just go all season like our other guest did?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And the reality is, and I don't want to contradict our message boards, the reality is it doesn't matter what you're driving if you don't drive according to conditions. You could have the best snow tires in the world, and if you insist on doing 70 instead of slowing down in the snow and ice, you're still going to go off the road. But that said, snow tires really do improve your grip on the road surface. They help cut through that snow and slush. And they give you much more traction. So without a doubt, we highly recommend that everybody put their snow tires on.
So the person who says, look, I've got four-wheel drive and I've got good all seasons, I'm going to be fine, you politely suggest that they should still look into snow tires.
That would be my suggestion. I mean, you know, four-wheel drive doesn't really do anything to help you once you're going. It might help you get started, but it's not going to help you stay on the road if you're driving too fast for conditions. And, you know, everybody always jokes about seeing the SUVs off in the median on the interstate, and they've all got four-wheel drive.
So you did mention you don't want to contradict the signs that are up, and people driving on the highways have probably seen them. I noticed today it looked like you've changed the message a little bit. I think the one that I saw today said something like 45 degrees or under, it's time for snow tires. So you really have been prompting people. Any chance you're going to get Vermonters who say, you can't tell me what to do?
Well, as we all know, and I'm a seventh generation Vermonter, none of us like being told what to do. However, you know, every year we get a nasty storm end of November, early December. And the last few years we've had some really icy storms for those early storms, and they tend to catch people off guard or unaware, and people tend to forget that it is winter in Vermont and there are going to be some slippery roads. So we thought this year we'd try and get out ahead of it a little bit and just sort of give people that extra nudge. Hey, are you thinking about your snow tires? And if you haven't, you probably ought to.
Now, Scott, when you talk about driving conditions, which you said is way more important than what kind of tires you have on your car, that's absolutely true. But how should people think about it? Because some kinds of snow, you can probably drive pretty close to your standard speed. Some kinds of precipitation, you need to slow way down. And there are some where really you just shouldn't be on the road at all. So can you give us a little bit of a rundown of what you think about with VTrans in terms of advising drivers?
Sure, and you're absolutely right. A lot depends on what type of precipitation you have, what the road surface looks like. But it's always a very tough question to answer. There's no magic formula that says, you know, if you're on the interstate and there's 2 inches of snow, you should drive 45 miles an hour. We do advise people of certain speeds, especially on the interstate, when the roads are bad, and we try to recommend 45 miles an hour or slower. But really, it all depends on the driver and what the road conditions are like. So, you know, there's no magic formula. Just slow down and drive according to conditions. You know, I've been out really in every storm we've had since I've been working for the agency for the last 12 years, and I've always been able to get where I'm going because I drive slowly and pay attention and you know, drive according to conditions.
You know, when you say drive according to conditions, that's the part that I think, as you said, is hard for some people. I mean, I've certainly had an experience that I think probably most people have where you think you've slowed down and that you're driving fine, and then I'll look around me and I will see cars just, you know, skidding all over the place, sliding around the road, especially on the interstates and off the road. And you think, oh my gosh, I wasn't trying to speed. I just didn't even think it was that icy, the black ice, for example.
Yeah, black ice is a really tricky one. Obviously, it can sneak up on you, and you have to pay attention to what the temperature is. You have to pay attention to what the road surface looks like. Sometimes you can see that sheen that gives away the presence of black ice. And certainly, you know, our hardworking men and women in our maintenance garages are the best at what they do, and they're out there trying to prevent that from happening. But Mother Nature always throws curveballs at us. Temperatures drop when they aren't expected to drop, and things happen. So it's really a matter of the drivers really paying attention to what's going on that road surface, paying attention to the surroundings. You know, you mentioned seeing cars off the road on the interstate, and that's certainly the area we see it the most as well. But I think a lot of that is just people not expecting the road conditions to be that slippery. They might see that the pavement looks bare, so they start accelerating and then lose traction.
When do you advise people to just stay off the roads? And when you do, do you think that they actually do it?
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked that. And you actually mentioned staying off the roads earlier. And I can remember, you know, when I was younger growing up in Vermont, there would be plenty of times it would snow and my parents would say, we're all staying in tonight. And you don't see that as much anymore. I think we live in a society that is an on-demand society. You know, everybody's got their smartphone and they have access to anything they want when they want it. And people expect to be able to travel when they want to travel. So we don't often say, stay home. But if we know there's going to be a really bad ice storm, if we know there's going to be, you know, like the infamous Valentine's blizzard we had a few years back, we'll definitely let people know that there are going to be some really hazardous driving conditions and that they should really think before they travel.
But you actually do think that this is in some ways a little bit of a cultural shift.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, the way that society thinks now as opposed to years ago, everything is at your fingertips, everything is on demand, everything is available when you want it. And I don't think people are as patient as they used to be.
Shifting a little bit from how people should drive and what conditions, can you talk a little bit about the work that VTrans does on looking at weather and trying to predict how many road crews you're going to need out and when and in what places and how you actually look at forecasts and do some forecasting to figure that out?
Sure. And obviously, weather is incredibly important to us to be able to do our jobs. And knowing what's coming That's the holy grail. You know, if we can know exactly what the weather's going to do and when it's going to do it, we'll never lose.
Yeah, you'd be a rich man if you could do that.
But that is such a challenge. And we do have a lot of tools at our disposal. We have great partnerships with the National Weather Service and with the folks at Linden State College and their weather department, who help give us specific forecasts around the state that are tailored to our different maintenance districts. We also have weather stations around the state that are constantly collecting data and feeding it back so we know what's going on in the pavement surface. And those are wonderful tools to help us react and plan accordingly. So there's a lot of emerging technology. We've got great partnerships with, for example, Velco and some others to share data and to try and all do a better job of being able to know what Mother Nature is going to throw our way and when.
All right, so keep an eye on the weather. V-Trans is keeping an eye on the weather, but bottom line, slow down, drive for the conditions, and as V-Trans tells us, get those snow tires on. Scott Rogers, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Scott is Director of Maintenance and Operations for the Vermont Agency of Transportation. And that's it for today. On Monday of this week, the Chittenden County Emergency Food Shelf served more people in a single day than it had ever served before. As the cold descends and we approach the holidays, we're going to talk on this show about hunger in Vermont. You can send your questions, your experiences with hunger, to vermontedition@vpr.net and tune in for the show tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Liam Connors directed the show, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.